Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. This episode is sponsored by the Jordan Harbinger Show, an eclectic and fascinating podcast you should definitely check out. I always find something worthwhile on Jordan's show, and I think you will too. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show, that's Jordan, H-A-R-B-I-N-G-E-R, in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. We've got a great show today. There's a new book out. It's called Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim. It came out on Tuesday. After you listen to this interview, you're probably going to want to go buy it. The author's name is Brandon Gauthier, which is spelled G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R. He explains why in the interview. And this is one of my favorite interviews I've done, I have to say. It went in directions I did not expect, and it was just parts of it totally blew my mind. So Brandon he can really tell a story, and he knows his stuff, and I'm excited to bring this to you. He got into this because he was he did his doctorate or his dissertation on North Korea and went to visit North Korea, and that's kind of how he got interested in dictators and life in these regimes. And he went and visited, and he talks about all this in the podcast, and he talks about some of these guys when they're younger, which you think to yourself, do I really want to read and hear about, you know, Hitler as a kid and Lenin in high school and stuff? And I was a little skeptical too, I'm going to be honest, but you'll see. I don't even need to tell you anymore. Just this guy can really, he really knows how to tell a story. This is a great interview. Excited to bring that to you. Before we get there, okay, so Elon Musk is buying Twitter, and I don't know, man. I just don't even know what to think. You know what? I think it's like, remember when they decided that there was going to be a new Batman, maybe like 15 years ago, whenever this was, 10 years ago. And we're like, oh, great. There's going to be a new Batman. And they're like, and it's going to be Ben Affleck. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, really? Ben Affleck? Batman? I kind of feel that way about Elon Musk. It's like, yeah, Elon Musk? Twitter? Really? I mean, why? And that's it. I don't know. And it's funny because in the Justice League movie, the Flash asks Ben Affleck's Batman, hey, what's your superpower? And he says, I'm rich, which also tracks to Elon Musk, right? So I don't know. I don't know that having this this guy who's very trollish controlling Twitter is going to be a good thing. I'm kind of hoping that the government steps in and shuts this down, because maybe, you know, one man shouldn't own all these different companies and have this much of a stake. And, you know, there's national security concerns as well. I mean, Twitter isn't just the platform. It's also all of the data on the platform, which includes, you know, direct messages. I mean, you know, they can read your direct messages. Like, now basically you have to think Elon Musk can read everybody's direct messages on Twitter. Like, everybody's, like, mine, yours, the president of wherever, you know, there's lots of people on Twitter tweeting things that are kind of important. And he's going to have all that data. If the sale goes through, which it seems like everyone's sort of acting like, oh, the sale's already gone through. I mean, are we sure it's going to go through? Because I don't know. Like, if you buy a house, you know, it takes like 3 weeks to close on a cash deal on a house because you got to do the title search. I mean, can they really sell Twitter in like 3 days? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So I think we're putting the cart a little bit before the horse here. I mean, there's still some, I would assume, stuff that they have to kind of iron out before he gets the keys to this this particular brand of Tesla. But I have to say, I have a weird feeling in the bottom of my gut about this. And it's not a good feeling. It's a feeling kind of like I felt, you know, after Kavanaugh got confirmed. It's a weird, uneasy feeling of, oh shit, you know. We say on the 5-8, if you've been watching the 5-8 with me and LB, she introduced a concept last week called Left of Boom, B-O-O-M, which the idea of that is that there's some big event that we can see coming, and that event is the boom. And you're either left of boom, which means it hasn't happened yet, and therefore you have some control over stopping it from happening, or you're at boom, which is means it's happening, or it's right of boom, which means it's too late. And I feel like Elon Musk buying Twitter, like it going through, is boom. It's boom. And I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I've become accustomed to Twitter. I kind of like it. You know, I've definitely made a name for myself on that particular social media platform. So, you know, I like Batman too, and I didn't want Ben Affleck to play Batman, but at the end of the day, he was fine. It wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. It was just, yeah, whatever. And that's, I think, the best we can hope for Elon Musk. Not great, not terrible, just whatever. I don't know. I don't think you'd pay that much money just to fuck something up and ruin it, but, you know, who knows? Far be it for me to tell you what's going on in the mind of Elon Musk. So, again, today, Before Evil, Young Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim. This book is available right now in paperback. Go buy it. It's good. He's good. We'll be right back with Brandon Gaucher.
A foreigner with a bad haircut just bought Twitter for 44 billion bananas, and you're in the market for a new social media platform. Me too. Hi, I'm country music legend Travis Tritt. I've been fixing to find a new social media platform since I banned most of Twitter for supporting Black Lives Matter. And now that an African American owns the Bird app, I reckon it's time to move on. So come join me on my brand new platform, Tritter. On Tritter, you get 241 characters, which is one more than 240. Instead of the little bird, we have a rhinestone cowboy. And every third post will feature my doppelganger, American hero Marjorie Taylor Greene, although that's also true of regular Twitter these days. I'm a big fan of both amendments, second and first, so if you think the existing social media platforms aren't racist enough, head on down to Twitter. Whiskey ain't working, neither's Elon Musk. Now, back to the show.
Brandon Gaucher, welcome to the Prevail Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Greg. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Now, your last name is spelled G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R.
Yeah.
I guess, what did I say? Gautier? And well,
I mean,
it could be Gauthier, but...
Give it a go again. I mean, yeah. This is kind of the beginning point for all conversations for me, whether I want it to be or not. And so if you say Gauthier... You know, that's not ideal. It's if you say Gautier, I'm not going to correct. I'm going to feel pretty good about that. But it is actually Gaucher, and that is a Cajun French perversion of Gautier. I'm originally from Louisiana, so Brandon Gaucher. It is a bit of a phonetic nightmare for some, but you know, I'm going to stand strong on that one, Greg.
I'm fine with it. As we were discussing earlier, my last name is always mispronounced. It's Oliar. It used to have a J in it. Which would have, if it was O-L-E-J-A-R, then everybody would just say Ola Jar, because people in the United States don't know what to do with a J in the middle of a last name. So either way, I was screwed. Everyone wants to make me Irish and put the little apostrophe in there. And there's no apostrophe. I'm not even remotely, there's literally not a drop of Irish blood in me at all. Other than, you know, people just wanting to add that little drop. So, okay. So Gaucher, which is a very cool name to pronounce it anyway, but I wanted to say it just in case people listening know, you know, when they want to go look for you, they know how it's spelled.
It's not helpful. I mean, they're going to go on. I mean, it said Gaucher and it is Gaucher, but I, you know, I'm happy we covered this. It feels, yeah. You know, I was going to laughably say it feels important, but it is part of my daily conversation. So thank you.
You're welcome, I guess. Okay. So now you have a book coming out. It's called Before Evil. And you write about a bunch of dictators and you write about their childhoods. So we're going to get into that. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you came to write something like this and, you know, who you are, basically.
I appreciate it. And, you know, as we're jesting about last names, now, you know, we start to transition into the discussion of how does one become absorbed with a really serious topic. I did my doctorate at Fordham University, focusing on the history of U.S.-North Korean relations. And throughout the course of doing my doctorate and having experiences with the different academics, a conversation that came up regularly was, well, have you been to North Korea? Do you know any North Koreans? And throughout the course of my doctoral program, I ended up going to North Korea in 2015. And it was part of a deep, long interest in North Korea, totalitarian state. What is it like for men and women like us to be living in a society like that? And at the heart of that totalitarian society, North Korea, is what Christopher Hitchens called, you know, the most religious place in the world. Where these leaders, where Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and today Kim Jong-un, are worshipped like gods. And I found myself looking in North Korea at this endless amount of propaganda. I mean, it is overwhelming. I mean, it is really relentless. And I started to think about the humanity of the inhumane. Who is Kim Jong-un as a person, right? We can riff on Dennis Rodman and all that, but at the end of the day, Kim Jong-un is a human being who grew up with Kim Jong-il as his father. What were the conversations between those two leaders like, right? I mean, so in one sense, this is where we get to an interesting, I think, discussion amongst historians and academics, where they will say, you know, I don't really care. I think it's trivial. And I think appropriately, it is important to say, first and foremost, that our greatest concern, right, should be the victims who suffer from this tyranny, the crimes against humanity that such despotic individuals carry out, that should resonate strongly above all else. And yet at the same time, if we were to truly understand the origins of those crimes against humanity, I think we have to engage despotic leaders as real people. And so throughout the course of this time in North Korea, including seeing the dead bodies of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, which was utterly bizarre and really weird, and looking at them, the human remains of those despotic tyrants, and thinking, who were they as people? This process of doing my dissertation on U.S.-North Korean relations, thinking about those North Korean leaders, led me back to a discussion of the humanity of the inhumane writ large. So who are some of the very worst tyrants of the 20th century? And that led me back to Vladimir Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, Mao, and Kim Il-sung. And what keeps me up at night is not only that human beings do such cruel and heinous things to one another, right? But also often that human beings do heinous and cruel things, not only for the sake of power, not only for the sake of their own ego, but because they believe it is right. That keeps me up at night. How do human beings define and rationalize evil, something being defined as an innate lack of empathy for others, as just? That's what led me to this project.
That's really interesting. All right, I want to get to the project, but now that you've opened the door on North Korea, for anyone unaware, North Korea is absolutely the most despotic, closed society that we have, you know, in a totalitarian way. It's the worst one that you could possibly live in, I think, for all of the time. That it's the most controlled, the most run by the state, the least interaction with the outside world. So you went there through the school? How did you get there? And what was it like? I mean, people meet you at the airport? People following you around? When was this also? What year?
So this is 2015.
Okay. So not that
and my
okay.
only reason for kind of chuckling in that moment is this is a serious thing. Like this is the discussion of how do you go safely? And it is so serious that you kind of take a moment and be like, is this real? Are you going to do this? Now, lots of people have gone to North Korea, right? There have been lots of people who have gone as tourists, and Americans have gone. This is not something that's completely unique, right? But what I did was I went to a British company called Corio Tours. I told them who I am. I'm not only, I will go as a tourist, right? But I am an academic. I am a writer, historian. I am researching this at great length. I am not going to North Korea to conduct any type of archival research, but I want to be very clear about who I am and what my interest is. And so there's no surprises, right? And through the advice of my advisors in graduate school, they said, this is how you could do it. You go and you be respectful and make no mistakes about where you are going. This is a heinous regime. And if you make bad decisions, they will take advantage of you. This is very, very serious. And there's no ultimate guarantee of your safety in a place ultimately where the regime can make the rules. So then the question is, right, thinking about the gravity of this, then why go? Then why take that risk? And, you know, I spoke about the notion of the humanity of the inhumane, right? These horrible tyrants like Kim Jong-un. But what also about the people who are living in his regime, right?
Yeah.
How often do we read and talk about North Korea, but we don't privilege the humanity of men and women living there enough, right? There's been a lot of focus on defectors, but what about the people living in Pyongyang? And not only those who find themselves in these horrible concentration camps, those who have either the courage to challenge the regime or fall foul of their ridiculous rules in terms of how one is supposed to carry oneself within this totalitarian state. But what about even the elites of Pyongyang, right? What about those men and women who did not ask to be born into the state but find themselves living there on a daily basis? So by going to North Korea, it was a chance to listen to the North Korean perspective, however heinous we might find that regime. Whenever I was asked contentious questions by the North Korean minders, who by the way, Greg, when I showed up, I said, annyeonghaseyo, like, good to see you. How are you? I speak Korean like a 3-year-old, you know, how are you? Nice to see you. Miguksuramimida or EAO. So anyway, and they said, you know, where are you from? I said, I'm American. And they scowled. and I said, well, do lots of Americans come? And my tour guide said, sometimes, but they're the ones who often make trouble. So, you know, I smiled and said, I'm really happy to be here. And I want to listen more than I talk. And whenever I was asked hard questions, or I was hearing something that I thought was a blatant historical fabrication, I would nod my head and say, you know, I'm here to listen to you. But really what stuck out to me throughout the course of that trip was that not only the opportunity to consider that there's a real human being running this regime in this country where you have so many millions of people trapped, but the opportunity to spend time with these North Korean guides and, you know, like them as people. And now we're getting into something contentious. Now we're getting into something provocative, right? Because how can you begin to develop something? And I'm not naive enough to say that we're friends, right? These are minders, government people who are supposed to watch me. And I have zero doubts about the fact that everything is being recorded potentially. Everything is on the record. This is very, very serious. But after I saw the dead body of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, which was one of the most religious experiences of my life, so to speak, right? I could go on at length about that. And I say that in quotes, religious experience. It was in a former palace, red lit, soft music playing in the background, totally bizarre experience. But then, you know, one of the minders asking me, a guy who I'm pretty sure was a security agent, saying, so what did you think about that? And I said, and there's like North Koreans going by crying because like this is a very serious thing. I don't think we should completely reject the extent to which this is. For many North Koreans are taught to worship these leaders, something approaching what we would call religious moment to see their remains. And the North Korean minder said to me, you know, so what did you think about this? And I said, it was very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to see it. And then we went on to talk about the fact that his wife was pregnant and how excited he was to have a baby. And I told him about my family. And we spent time talking about each other's families. The most interesting experience I can relate is being at Panmunjom, being at the demilitarized zone, the former truce village, so to speak, and a North Korean soldier coming up to me, an officer. And I'm with this tour guide group, right? So I'm with 15 people or so. And he comes up to me and we exchange a few words in Korean and he asked me where I'm from. And I say, I'm an American. And his response, he looked at me and he just said, you know, aside from saying kind of, why are you here? That look, you know, what are you doing? How can you be here when we hate you so much? And I said in Korean, I love the Korean people, North and South, and we might disagree about politics emphatically, and you might choose to hate my government, and we might choose to hate yours. But I don't think people should demonize people of North Korea who have families, who want the best lives for their kids. And then he pointed at an American, he kind of laughed at me. He was like, that's cute, all right? And he pointed at him, and he wasn't disrespectful. It's a very serious vibe, you know? And he points at an American soldier that you can see across the border. And he says to me, so what if we were in the United States, right? And I could point out to you North Korean soldiers in your country. Why do Americans come to my country to make war? And so, you know, I try to emphasize that I have no doubt that that soldier is a courageous individual, and that they would fight for the United States, and they would fight for the United States aims. But I imagine that person probably joined the military, if we are to make assumptions. Maybe this person joined the military for tuition to go to college, right? Like, we don't know if that's the case. And I hope that when you see him, you see a human being and not so much kind of the demonic soldier here who's going to carry out war crimes against the Korean people. So that's what I took away, Greg. I saw real people. I saw human beings, and I thought about them as human beings. Thought about the humanity of those that we often don't take into consideration. But that all being said, I just want to say I have no illusions about North Korea. I would not encourage anybody without a very specific reason for going. Now it's illegal for Americans to go. I would not encourage anybody without very carefully defined specific reasons for going. Anyone who does not understand that regime at a great depth its history and is not aware of the risk, it would be an irresponsible thing to go without fully appreciating those things. So what I'm saying now, I don't say any of this lightly, and I would encourage anyone listening to fully consider what this regime is and what it's done.
It's pretty horrible, and thank you for sharing that, because it's fascinating. I don't know anybody that's been in North Korea. One time at a convention in Berlin, we met with we saw and shook hands with two North Koreans who were at this particular thing. And my friend who was with me said, God, in order for them to travel here, it must be quite a thing. They must be pretty high up in the regime for them to be trusted enough to leave the country, because that's the sort of place where if you leave, they'll just take your family and put them in the prison. I mean, you know, as I understand it, the first dictator there, they would just, you know, if your father did something, you were screwed and stuff like that. It's really not fair. And it's interesting that they hate Americans, because that's obviously part of the indoctrination.
Yeah.
Part of the training, you know, so that they're just taught probably to do that. Or perhaps they just have only the Kardashians beamed into their TV sets and develop this anti-Americanism on their own. I don't know.
I think focusing, and anyone who's interested, my dissertation focuses on the U.S. the history of U.S. North Korean relations, right? And it tries to understand the American perspective and, you know, North Korea, or the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. That's their formal name. And the North Korean perspective ultimately is, you burned every inch of our country to the ground in what was a civil war, which you had no business intervening in. They would say, would it have been right for, and I'm not endorsing this North Korean perspective as much as I'm trying to create context for the North Korean perspective. Would it have been right if a foreign country, and this might sound ridiculous, what if Korea had intervened in the American Civil War on behalf of the Confederacy? Their argument is that it was a civil war in 1950, and that the United States intervened in a conflict that would have been over in 3 weeks. North Korea would have won. And then that there was a really, really, and this is a fact, the bombing raids against North Korea were really, really bad. And the immense devastation of that conflict has deeply shaped the North Korean state thereafter. But I think the individuals responsible for the tyranny of that state are the leaders of North Korea, first and foremost. I think Kim Il-sung is the one responsible for what has followed that conflict. And he was the one who chose to carry out that invasion of South Korea. And just one more word on North Korea as a place. The crimes against humanity that are carried out there are almost beyond description. And the fact that we, as we are talking right now, have to come to terms with the fact that there are human beings living in the gulag camps that regime runs, it should make us shudder deeply. It is a place, it is a nightmarish place at times, these gulags all the time. But when I say at times, I mean, there's also love in North Korea, Greg, you know, I mean, they're also husbands and wives. There are people who want the best for their kids, and I'm interested in their situation. And the dissertation sought to speak to this larger history, the perspective of both sides. And there's so much more to say there, but then in part that brings us back to, as I was saying here a minute ago, Kim Il-sung, the leaders who oversee these types of regimes.
Yeah. Do you think, now you went in 2015, so you obviously have not been back since the Trump administration, but do you think that Trump's, what's the word? Friendship, I want to say, BFF-hood with Kim Jong-un has helped in any way dispel these anti-American sentiments there? I mean, certainly between Trump and Dennis Rodman, they must have some love of some of these characters. I'm saying this half jokingly, but I'm actually serious. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, they've seen him hang out with Trump, with the American president. That has to mean something.
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. And the first is certainly that led to a diminishing of tensions. This is not an endorsement of Trump's close friendship with, and he's, I believe it's, is it he who's described as a friendship? I would like to go back and look at specific words, but I think that's an appropriate framing of it, right? Based on how Trump sees this relationship. Mm-hmm. Certainly that led to diminishing of tensions with North Korea. But the other side of it is, North Korea's use of the United States is kind of the ultimate boogeyman. And I say that with perspective of the fact that North Korea does view itself as being this tiny state that has stood to the superpower that's been bullying it. That's the North Korean perspective. The Korean War was unbelievably horrible. But that all being said, the United States is this kind of this ultimate scapegoat for everything. So they can't flip the switch overnight on everything. I mean, can't all of a sudden, the US isn't going to be best friends. That almost eats away at like the reason for the regime's existence, which is defiance of foreign imperialism. And the other side of this is, oh, the North Korean state media loved it. Oh my goodness, all they've ever wanted was for an American president to be like, you are our equal. And of course, it was framed in the North Korean media as, you know, and I paraphrase here, right? Like, the United States of America has finally recognized the greatness of the dear respected leader, Kim Jong-un, and the power and might of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Finally, after decades of struggle, Washington has come to realize that we are a force that must be respected. Like, that's the frame, and they loved it. Oh, it's endless, endless propaganda value. You know, the discussion of diplomacy of North Korea, whether that can yield results, a much larger discussion. I can only say that that friendship was weird in terms of kind of going beyond, like, you know, there's a long history of Kennedy meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna, right, 1961, and FDR having martinis with Stalin, right? So, I mean, like, and Stalin complained that the martinis weren't to his taste. This happened during World War II. So in all seriousness, there is precedent for these types of relationships. But the other side of that is, of course, the level of camaraderie, almost, if you will, between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump was disconcerting. Donald Trump framed it, of course, as, you know, I've stopped the nuclear war here from happening, and so on and so on. But that's a much larger discussion. But at the end of the day, he found himself with Kim Jong-un, a real person who is a human being. And when I was at a conference, I met, it was a conference on North Korea, and I met someone who was a fluent Korean speaker. And he said, I just got back from North Korea. And I was like, wow, that's cool. Or that's interesting. Excuse me. No, what's really interesting is what he says next. I was the translator for Dennis Rodman when he was visiting. I was like, and at this point, I was kind of like, really? Like, that's really the case. And he was like, I held his baby daughter. And he took out his phone and showed me a photo of him standing next to Kim Jong-un and holding his daughter. So what struck me in that moment and what I think is relevant to this conversation is, I imagine Kim Jong-un wants to see his daughter grow up. I'm curious about the relationship of dictators, not only as horrible, horrible tyrants, right? But as someone who is a son or a father. And I'm particularly interested in the origins, not so much of tyranny, because not everything in youth, you can't draw a straight line from events that happen when someone is a young person to crimes against humanity when they're an adult. It's not that simple. But youth matters. It's a big part of the story. And that's what led me to write this current book, Before Evil, the youths of these heinous despots. What do we have in common with them? Who were they as human beings? And if some historians would say humanizing anecdotes are trivial, if not inappropriate, why should we see it differently?
thank you, because that's a really good segue to the next part of the show. So what we're going to do now is take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Brandon Gaucher.
The Jordan Harbinger Show combines in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating individuals, people like General Michael Hayden, Ambassador Michael McFaul, with Friday feedback episodes, where he responds to listener questions about everything from conventional problems like when to ask for a raise at work, to doozies like how do you help a family member escape a cult. His guests are a fascinating blend of heavy hitters like Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, and H.R. McMaster, as well as lesser-known people who, in my opinion, are, you know, even more interesting. Like, Jordan just did a two-part episode with Joe Barone, the country's longest operating mob informant. Which is, you know, that's cool stuff, man. That's right in the roundhouse of the Prevail podcast, for sure. So, whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you'll find something useful that you can apply to your own life. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or it could just be discovering a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's Jordan, like Michael Jordan, H-A-R-Binge, as in, you know, a lot of episodes at once, R, Harbinger, in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. All right, we're back with Brandon Gaucher. Before the break, you were talking about humanizing these tyrants, and your book, Before Evil, we're going to talk about it in a second. I had Ruth Ben-Ghiat on my show, as you know, and her book, she also looks at the lives of these dictators and sort of studies it, in particular, the idea of machismo, and she goes into the sex lives of some of these guys because it's so horrible, and it informs a lot of what they do. Not all of them, but a lot of them. You know, certainly Mussolini, certainly Gaddafi. I mean, the Gaddafi chapter in Ruth's book is one of the most horrifying things I've ever read in my life. But I think that there is a case to be made that we need to study who these people are and what makes them tick in the way that they tick. So tell us a little bit about your book. Like, how is it set up? And then maybe we can go in and talk about the early lives of some of these horrible, horrible people.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I have to comment on Ruth Ben-Ghiat's book on strongmen and that chapter on Gaddafi, which I think is a useful lens through beginning this discussion. It'll lead us into something about Mussolini. You know, Muammar Gaddafi was a monstrous, monstrous man.
Yeah,
and the sexual violence that he was guilty of against countless innocents is it's really, really disturbing. And Dr. Ben-Ghiat's book goes into great depth about, you know, what was that like, these sexual crimes that Gaddafi carried out. In the end, as we know, as the Arab Spring is taking shape and Libyans overthrow Gaddafi, he is pulled from a drainage pipe and physically assaulted and abused, and then he is murdered. And I remember seeing that on television, and I think about it now, right? And how do we come to terms with human beings who do utterly inhuman things to other human beings? How should we understand their legacy? How are they treated in the end? What happens to them? And that leads me to a discussion about Mussolini that I mentioned in my book. Mussolini meets a similar end.
Yes.
He is arrested by partisans near Lake Como. He is led with his mistress and he is put beside a gate and he is shot. And then from there, he is taken to Milan and strung up with a number of other criminals from the fascist regime. He's hung upside down, but this is not before his body is physically assaulted. Women apparently urinate on his body. His head becomes mangled and it is a really grisly scene. And one anti-fascist Italian journalist wrote, "What happened to Mussolini was justice, but to have spared his life, to not have executed him, would have been sacred." And I really struggle with that.
Yeah.
I really struggle with that, right? Same thing for Gaddafi, right? The victims of Gaddafi's crimes might say, what happened to this tyrant? This was justice, right? But how do we look at these individuals as human beings? And so the next question then is the larger legacy of someone like Hitler or Stalin or Mao. Can we feel empathy for people who felt for the most part, no empathy for anyone. And that's how I define evil in the context of the book. Before evil, evil is this mode of thought, right? Where I don't feel for this person as I am doing horrible things, or transcending that, millions of people. I don't consider the moms and dads whose kids aren't coming home. I don't consider what it is subjectively like to be a human being experiencing that type of torture. But so if we know that these individuals have done such horrible things, and we cannot begin to quantify, we can talk about numbers of deaths, right? The level of emotional misery and suffering these men caused, can we feel empathy for them? Is that appropriate? That is part of what this book is about. And I think the argument that I embrace is no amount of describing their humanity will ever excuse their crimes. Their guilt is total and absolute, right?
Yeah.
But what can distinguish us as human beings is to engage their stories with a degree of feeling that I think is missing in the historiography. All the books about these men treat them almost as if they are demons from another time, when the reality is that these are human beings with which we share a lot in common. No one wants to hear that, Greg. No one wants to start the conversation with, like, so what do Mao and I, like, how might Mao and I have seen something similarly? What similar experiences might we have had? And so the book does this. It has three parts. Before Evil starts with opening chapters that begin to describe them as adults, as dictators. It goes into great detail about their crimes against humanity, because there needs to be no doubt about who these men were. There would be no questioning that these people committed crimes against humanity. Then the second and third part of the book focuses on their childhoods, their educations, friendships, in some cases, first loves. The book only uses, in the body of the book, beyond the introduction, first names or nicknames as a way of trying to cue the reader into thinking about who these men were as human beings beyond the cult of personality that they wanted to define themselves through, and these monstrous crimes against humanity, which I think appropriately lead us to view them in this monstrous, monstrous light. But evil alone did not define them. They were once children. They were once born and drank breast milk and grew up and fell in love, enjoyed school, made good and bad grades, and wept and thought about what they would be when they grew up and realized that they too were going to die someday.
Dictators, they're just like us. No, the
this is where the listener is going to chime in and say, but were they really? Aren't there psychopathological? Doesn't psychopathology exist for a reason, right?
Well, but
these
evil,
people inherently insane, and that's
evil,
conversation we can have.
Nobody thinks that they're evil, you know. Even the most evil people don't think that they're evil. Vladimir Putin, as we're recording this, it's Sunday, March 13th. Vladimir Putin isn't sitting around in his wherever he is by his long table thinking, you know what I am? I'm just evil right now. Yeah, he thinks he's the hero of his own story, and so did Hitler, and so did Stalin, and all of that. And I think that, you know, their childhoods and what happened to them and informed them, whether it was nature and nurture or what, or some confluence of historical events that made them what they are, it pays off to learn about it, because maybe it's something that we can spot, you know, traits that maybe somebody else we might recognize coming up and saying, maybe this guy shouldn't be allowed to, you know, be the president, for example, in the case of Trump or whatever. 25 years ago, I don't know that someone would have looked at Putin as being somebody this evil necessarily, but obviously he is. So you're looking pensive. If you want to comment on what I just said.
Well, I guess what I struggle with, and that a core purpose of the book is to ask the public and readers to struggle with, is not only the notion, right, that we begin to look for parallels about the path to tyranny, the path to despotism. How do we recognize such individuals? But you said something really important, which is that those who commit crimes against humanity all so often don't believe what they're doing is wrong. Now, to be clear, there are individuals, right, who know something is wrong, and they do it even though it's wrong, and they enjoy it, right? Mental illness can come into this, the notion of sadism and so on, right? But for these dictators specifically, they believe what they're doing is utterly righteous. They come to believe from a young age, for a lot of reasons we can talk about, that they have a special role to play. Putin is a perfect example of that, that he is going to save Russia. And not only is it a discussion of, you know, I'm not necessarily evil. Of course, I'm not evil. It's that they are this hero in their own mind in terms of a larger ideological and historical story. But the relevance of that to ourselves is not only our ability to spot such people. It is the question of how do we ourselves become the villains without realizing it? How do we ourselves become wrapped up in belief systems where we might begin to view another side as so despotic, to even begin to dehumanize them? And then we begin to say, well, there are these larger ideological ends we have to achieve, right? And by the way, it seems like we're going to have to do some disturbing things to get there. But of course we're going to, because the end route could be paradise. It could solve all of our problems. And actually, if you are not willing to join us and what some might consider crime, so to speak, but what we consider is something that is a necessity, then we have real questions about your loyalty. There can be no neutrality on this. We have to be all in on this. These dictators came to believe that what they were doing was something inherently just in terms of a larger ideological cause. Crass opportunism and the desire for power went hand in hand with that in many ways. The question is, how do we ourselves become wrapped up in ideological narratives where we begin to believe that we are the ones who are utterly so right? And in doing so, we begin to justify things that can be really, really horrible. I think the line between people doing horrible things, knowing they are horrible, and people doing horrible things, believing that they are utterly just, is not always so clear as we'd like it to be. And I think by looking at what we have in common with the very worst, we begin to appreciate that a little bit more.
Did you see the documentary Exterminate All the Brutes on HBO?
Oh, no, I haven't yet.
It's this 6-part thing, and he talks about, there's a lot of Nazi stuff in there. He talks about colonialism as being sort of a through line, and there's lots of really creepy footage of Nazis being happy and dancing and basically humanizing them, because, you know, Hitler took a model that the colonial powers were using in Africa and the United States had used in North America and applied it to Europe. And the argument in the documentary is that we, as Western society, want to like make it seem like what Hitler did was isolated, and it was just a crazy thing, when in fact it was more part of this larger picture. And all he did was put a wrinkle on it by saying, instead of invading, you know, Angola or whatever, we're going to invade Poland, and do to the Poles what. Anyway, what you were just saying made me think of that.
Well, and also, yeah, absolutely. He looked at what happened in the American West with the genocide against Native Americans as having been an example to follow. But okay, so then the relevance to this book, right? He was reading, Hitler was not, as an adult, some of what we would call a bibliophile. He's not as much of a reader, right? He's other's despots. But growing up, he is a big reader. He's often only reading to affirm what he already thinks. But Carl May, this German writer who riffed on the American Wild West, were some of Hitler's favorite works as a kid. As an adult, he talked about them repeatedly. What are the origins, not even so much of the larger ideological belief systems, something like Nazism alone, right? But how does someone like Hitler as a child, right, begin to read and fall in love with narratives that intersect with who he could be, this heroic narrative? So I think that's a very interesting thing that intersects with what you're saying.
Well, why don't we go there? Talk a little bit about should we start with Hitler and his youth? Like what did you find there? Because there's a lot of mythology around Hitler at this point.
I never fail to be that much more disturbed by the life story of, you know, one of the very worst people who ever lived. What disturbed me so much about Hitler's story, though, is looking at things we don't often talk about, which is, if you ask someone on the street, and I'm making an assumption, but it's an assumption I've seen borne out repeatedly, what do you think gave rise to the evil of Adolf Hitler, who's responsible for starting a world war in Europe, which would ultimately kill tens of millions of people, responsible for the murder of 6 million Jewish men, women, and children? What do you think happened in his childhood, right? And the common answer is, well, I imagine this person was the product of trauma, a lot of abuse. And that's part of the story for sure. Hitler had a bad dad. Hitler's dad was very abusive towards him, towards his half-brother. But the defining story of Hitler's childhood, and this is the parallel with Mao and Stalin and Mussolini and Kim Il-sung and Lenin, is not trauma. It's a certain degree of privilege. and is a certain degree of having a loving parent. His father's horrible. His father's really bad. He dies when Hitler's a teenager. The most important relationship in Hitler's life is not what psycho historians would talk about, the abuse at his father's hand. So that was important, right? That's part of his experience. It was his mom. He had a wonderful mom. Clara Hitler had lost several kids before Adolf, quote unquote, comes along. And his sister Paula would say, as well as his half brother, Adolf Jr., that she spoiled him. She loved him deeply, that she wanted her son to have everything. And she was determined to see this kid grow up and have certain opportunities in his life. And that relationship is an absolute critical part of who he is as a kid. It's relevant to the story of who he will become in the sense that his dad wanted him to be a customs official, argued with him. Hitler, and classic cliche, I want to be an artist, And that was actually true. He wanted to be an artist. The dad, classic father-son argument. No son of mine's going to be an artist. You're going to be a bum, right? And when I speak in this tone, I don't mean to make light of it as much as I mean to remind the listener that this is relevant to our lives. How many among us had this argument? But I want to do this, and you're not going to do this. That's not practical. His father dies, and the mom kind of, parrots the dad's talking point, but the mom gets on board with Hitler being an artist. When he's 16, he's a high school dropout. He's bumming around Linz. He has a dear friend named Gustl, who he spends most of his time with. We can get to him in a little bit. And he almost is given the equivalent, right, of, and maybe this is too reductive, right, but we almost might call it a gap year, where rather than going on to school, the mother tells him, draw, spend time in Linz. And even when other family members push Adolf Hitler to become a baker, to go on, right, and do something practical, his mom provides him a room while she's sharing a room with the aunt and the other sister. And he has certain privileges within that. And it's through this that we see a defining moment of Hitler's life, which is when Clara Hitler dies of breast cancer, just as he's about to go off, and even his decision to want to try to go to art school in Vienna and to try to be somebody, right? Turn this already noxious egotism at a young age, if I'm going to be a great artist, into something concrete. It's because it's in part, his mother's dying. And I think he wants to show her that, I'm going to be okay. And as she dies of breast cancer, he comes back to Vienna. And by the way, he was never accepted to the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna. He lies about that. He lies and says he was accepted. To what extent she knew the truth, we don't know. But he takes care of Clara Hitler as she dies. And this is corroborated by their doctor, who was an Austrian Jewish man, who will say that he had never seen someone so crushed. And the last weeks of her life, Hitler will make her dinner, care for her, hand over foot. And when she dies, it is a crushing moment in his life. And this brings us to a question for the listener. Can we feel empathy for teenage Adolf Hitler, who has not yet committed crimes against humanity, who is not yet the Nazi tyrant we know him to be? Do we get to feel empathy for him in that historical vacuum of that moment? And if we do, does that distinguish ourselves from his tyranny? That's a core issue of the book. And I think that we should. I think that engaging with his humanity helps us understand that this is someone who goes on to this tyranny. The question of how is very interesting, as it is disconcerting. But also, again, it distinguishes ourselves from these monstrous individuals, even as we find and acknowledge our own susceptibility to noxious ideological belief systems and radicalism that can lead to crimes against humanity. By the way, the Jewish doctor that takes care of Hitler's mom is later allowed to leave Austria after the Anschluss, after the unification, forcible, coercive unification of Austria and Germany. And that doctor will write an article or give an interview during World War II and basically say, I feel certain I was given certain privileges that no other Jew in Austria was. And so even the worst of the worst, Adolf Hitler, allowed the doctor who took care of his mom to leave Austria. And after she had died, teenage Hitler went to that doctor and had bowed to him and said, I will never forget what you did for my mother, taking care of her and being kind to her.
That's stunning. Oh my God. What a story. I don't even know how to process that. I really don't.
I don't either. Thinking about these things, there are a lot of questions that come up for debate. How do we process it? How should we?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm the sort of person that I feel empathy for everybody almost to a degree. Like I watch, it's hard for me to, you know, root for even when people are that I know I've been for 5 years now screaming and yelling that people should be indicted. But as soon as people are in, you know, in court, I feel bad for them always. That's the sort of person that I am generally. So it's hard. It's hard when you, you know, it comes back also to the idea you were talking about before with Mussolini and with Gaddafi and the idea of punishment. Like, you know, yeah, these people deserved, if anybody deserves to die in a horrible way, it's those guys. And yet it feels weird to be rooting for someone's death. It feels weird now to be thinking, you know, if Putin died right now, it would probably save a lot of lives. It would probably be, in a general big picture way, it would be a wonderful thing for the entire planet and might save all of humanity if the nuclear war thing is at all at risk. And, you know, I don't want to be rooting for that. You know, it makes me feel bad. It makes me feel evil, frankly, to be rooting for somebody else's death, even someone who deserves it, you know, in theory.
There's such a moral quandary there. And I would say that accountability and just, some degree of just punishment, that nothing can remove the necessity of that for people who commit these crimes against humanity. But I would say, how do we engage with what you're just describing? It is really, really hard. But I draw here on the words of George Kennan, George Kennan's long telegram at the beginning of the Cold War. And he said that the greatest danger we face, and I'm paraphrasing, this isn't the exact quote, but the greatest danger we face in dealing with such an enemy as the Soviet Union is that in seeking to combat them, that we ourselves become like them. Mm. And so when we think about the notion of justice for these criminals, for these mass murderers, when we think about how we struggle against them in the present and in our historical understanding, we have to continue to consider how do we not dehumanize them in a way that distracts us from the fact that the origins of inhumanity are inherently human. That monsters aren't real. Let me say that again. Monsters don't literally. Now, there are people who do horrible things that are deeply monstrous, but even they themselves, whether they be mentally ill, whether that be a psychopathological issue, which can intersect with these men, or that be something where an utterly quote unquote rational person does these things, the explanations are explicable. If we demonize and we suggest that it's a demon from another time, that suggests that there's this inexplicable evil that we can't understand, I reject that.
This is very interesting. It reminds me, this might have nothing to do with it, but it reminds me of a story from the 11th century where there was a famous battle called Manzikert, where the Byzantine emperor Romanus Diogenes sort of foolishly went into Anatolia to try to retake land from the Turks and went too far because he was brash and wound up getting captured by the Sultan, whose name was Alp Arslan. And the lion, they called that, was the heroic lion, I think that meant in Turkish. And the Sultan said to the emperor, what would you do if you had kidnapped me and captured me in battle like this? And he said, I would probably parade you in chains in front of the crowd, and then I would have you executed. And Alp Arslan said to him, I'm going to do something even worse. I'm going to set you free. And he did. Isn't that cool? I don't even know what that means, but it didn't end well for him when he was set free. Let's put it that way.
It's a powerful story. And it raises as many questions, right, as it answers, right?
I'm going to do something worse.
What followed that being set free? But the debate around what we're talking about is, I think there are going to be critics who say that the psychopathological aspect, shouldn't that transcend the notion of humanizing what we have in common? I talk about that in the introduction, some caveats of this. It's not psychohistory. I'm not a trained psychopathologist. That's not what the book is about. The book is about making essentially two arguments. And the first argument is that trauma, which we normally use to define the lives of people like Joseph Stalin, is not the most, I don't think it's the best lens to understanding the origins of their personas and their path to power, if not necessarily, you know, drawing a straight line from who they were as kids to their crimes against humanity as adults. I don't think you can do that. But who they were going to be, that begins in their youth in terms of their personas and their worldview. And privilege and good education and books and teachers that in ways we don't expect, even for someone from an impoverished background like Stalin, is a really big part of the story. And that's not really talked about. That's not something that I think a historian or a writer yet had looked at their lives, those parallels. And that's what strongly stands out, a love of good books. They're all huge readers. They're bibliophiles. I mean, Mussolini, Mao, Stalin, and Lenin. And we haven't even gotten to Vladimir Lenin's Christmas trees as a kid and the fact that they dyed Easter eggs. And he had a wonderful mother and father. We haven't even gotten to that. But privilege, good educations. And then two, that somewhere along the way in their youths, the vision of themselves intersects with novels and the beginnings of what will be their ideological worldviews. Not even that they can define it yet. There's no, you know, books about Hitler's youth would particularly, August Kubizek would talk about, you know, the earliest origins of anti-Semitism in his youth. But that's not the defining part of his youth as much as it is Hitler beginning to imagine that he is this great genius.
Yeah,
he has something to do. And we see that in all their lives. So one, an emphasis on privilege and education. And then two, the origins of their self-conviction, the so what of personal meaning, that they are special, that they have something to do. That's a big part of what the book argues.
That's interesting. I mean, they're all sort of creative types, too, to some degree, right? So Hitler's a painter, you know, with his watercolors. I know Stalin wrote poems and was a great tenor, apparently, when he was a boy, like that. And, you know, Mussolini was a journalist and obviously was really good with the marketing stuff. So
he was also a school teacher, but he couldn't control small children. I'm not kidding. He was, and guess who else was a school teacher? His mom. He had a close relationship with his mom. He became a school teacher like his mom. And he worked 1 year in a village school, and he was a disaster. He couldn't control the kids. He had a really tumultuous affair. He was giving impromptu speeches, haranguing the town. But yeah, there is that creative aspect. And so if we look at someone like Lenin, he's a phenomenal student in high school. Someone like Vladimir Lenin would have could have gone on to be a great lawyer. Hitler as this genius wannabe artist, but his commitment to art and then particularly architecture, which he actually knows something about, that was real. For Mussolini, it's the possibility of being a school teacher. For someone like Mao, who also, by the way, was a teacher. He used to teach, by the way, in his early 20s without a shirt on in class. He was criticized for that. And he said, "You're lucky I'm not nude." Mao was less concerned with his appearance and more concerned with debating Bismarck's legacy in his 20s. This is someone who's obsessed with the realm of ideas. His friend at the time will later say, like, you know, "You're a slob," and I'm paraphrasing, you know, "Your room's a mess. How can someone clean up the universe, right, if they can't take care of their appearance?" And he would say, anybody who's concerned about such trivial things has no ambition, has no possibility of doing anything great in life. There's so much bigger things to worry about than something as trivial as what you look like. I'm concerned with ideas. So there is that artistic element to some extent, or at the very least, the conviction of that they're going to have a path before them that is going to be profound, even if it is on the level of Stalin becoming a priest, or someone like Lenin being a lawyer, and so on.
I want to get to, I don't think we're going to have time to go into all of these characters, but I do want to know more about Lenin, because I don't actually know that much about him. So I'm curious about that. I want to say the one quick weird Mao story that I know, which is not from his youth, but after Kennedy was shot, he was asked, how do you think the world would be different if Khrushchev was killed instead of Kennedy? And he said, "I don't think that Aristotle Onassis would have married Mrs. Khrushchev." That was his answer.
Something like that sounds that sounds like something he would say.
We could sit here all day and not come up with a better answer to that question, by the way.
I know, right? You know, I can imagine someone saying, you know, you mentioned this, these are very interesting points, right? You mentioned the notion of Mao teaching without a shirt. Someone might say, shouldn't we be talking about the fact that 45 million people died as a result of Mao's policies during the Great Leap Forward? I can imagine someone saying, like, you know, why is this important, these stories? And I feel profoundly they are. Someone like Mao Zedong from a young age, if we're going to understand the Cultural Revolution or the Great Leap Forward, and the immense evils that he will bring to bear on, you know, a proud and great nation like China, come back to the notion that he is going to be this hero, that the rules for him are going to be different, that he has a vision of what can be, and he is going to do whatever he wants to achieve those larger ends. And he is not concerned with being constrained by anything. He'll say at times that conscience, conscience is only there to guide us into making better decisions. I mean, and that the great man of history, so to speak, which is a historical fallacy in its own right, you know, he must be willing to do these hard things. And so the little anecdotes speak to the larger composite of how someone comes to carry out policies which kill tens of millions of people and be utterly unapologetic that this is something that had to happen and to never come to terms with the suffering they caused. By the way, very quickly before we get into Lenin, another example of this with Mao would be Mao meeting the Japanese prime minister in the early 1970s. And the legacy of Japan's war against China is so horrific in terms of the crimes against humanity that were committed there. So it was a very big historic moment for Mao to be engaging with the Japanese prime minister. And not only Mao saying things like, you know, well, actually the Japanese war against China was critical to the CCP coming to power. I should thank you for it. It was hugely important. Actually saying things like that. But at one point they're having a cocktail and Mao kind of stares off at the distance, talks about like, oh, I think this is 65 proof. And then kind of gazes and says something along the lines of, I hated my father. Bizarre comments in the midst of like a moment of diplomacy. They kind of gaze off and talk about his dad. And, there are a lot of interesting overlaps between childhood and adulthood that don't necessarily draw a straight line, but there is, I think, not enough discussion about the meaning of their youths, not as explaining for a fact how the Cultural Revolution came to be, but it's a part of that story, which then brings us to Vladimir Lenin. And it's a sad story. Vladimir Lenin was raised in a home with his mom and dad were model parents in many respects. His dad had worked his way into Imperial Kazan University from ultimately what we would consider a lower socioeconomic background. His dad becomes an educator and then is ultimately appointed to create schools around the town of Simbirsk, where they're from. The dad ends up becoming a noble. He gets a title. That's like a civilian title. It's like the equivalent of being a general. Like his dad becomes a reasonably significant functionary within the area where they live in terms of working for the government to create schools. And the dad is really passionate about education. The mom is a wonderful mom. She's a great pedagogue. She teaches all the kids. They all have great educational opportunities. And like, you know, they come up with like a faux literary journal when they're all like five, when Lenin's like 5 years old. There's this, this really does, wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, there's this really, yeah, the mom's teaching them the pun in German and French. And it is a very, at times, idyllic childhood filled with ice skating and sledding and all these types of things. Lenin's older brother, Alexander, who I use the nickname Sasha for him in the book, is a star. He's a straight A student. He graduates first in his class at the equivalent of high school for them. And he goes on to university in St. Petersburg. And the dad tells him before he goes, and we're talking about Lenin's older brother, and their dad says, you know, don't become involved in politics, whatever you do, stay away from politics, right? And the dad will tell them growing up, you know, there's nothing worse. Dad never really talks about politics, but when Alexander, the grandfather of Tsar Nicholas II, is assassinated by radicals, right? Alexander II, they'll go to the funeral, not the funeral in St. Petersburg, Moscow, but the town funeral in Simbirsk. And the dad will tell them, what rogues, what fools would have killed the Tsar and really condemn political radicalism. Fast forward, Sasha goes to university. Their dad dies while he's at school. And Sasha starts to read about a political economy. He starts to fall in with the wrong groups, wrong study circles. They start to read a lot of Marx. And it was always stunning to me that something as dry as Marx could inspire people to become terrorists, right? Lots of kids come home from college as Marxist. Not all come home as terrorists.
Yeah.
Sasha becomes a terrorist. He goes from being a gold medal award winning at his high school straight A student to someone who falls in with the wrong groups. And ultimately, Lenin is finishing his senior year of high school. And Lenin, of course, is not his real last name. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. He's finishing high school. He's taking trigonometry exams. He's doing translations of Thucydides. And a letter comes for his mom. And it says that Sasha's been arrested for a conspiracy to kill the czar. And, you know, Lenin looks up and says, this isn't good. And maybe the most understated thing you could say, like, this is going to end bad. It's going to end badly. The mom rushes to St. Petersburg to try to save the son. The son, in court basically says, I'm not sorry. I believe that everything I did was right. Yeah, I 100% believe that this is a tyranny, and we need, and of course he was going to try to kill the czar with bombs that would have killed innocent people. It's a story within itself, how a straight A student goes on to become a terrorist. Anyway, Lenin is one day sitting on a bench, and I talk about this in the book, and another student comes to sit next to him, and he's pensive. He's not saying anything. And the student says, like, are you okay? Like, what's going on? And Lenin very quietly says, they hanged my older brother. And it sits out there in the air, that thought. And as someone who never had any interest whatsoever in politics, he had no interest before his brother's death in anything relating to Marxism. He starts to wonder, how could this have happened? The other part of the story is that we have a straight A student who is intellectually brilliant, who now has the tools to begin to try to discern, how did this happen? And he starts with one conviction, which is, if Sasha did this, he must have believed it was right. That was his beginning conviction. He must have done this because he thought it was right. And then somewhere along the way, Lenin begins to ask, could I succeed where my brother failed? He never really talks about his brother after that. As an adult, he almost never talks about him.
Interesting. Because he legit did. I mean, it just in the simple case of killing the czar, I mean, you know, he did.
Yeah. And he said, if it was necessary to behead, and here's the part that, here's where we switch over. Here's where things get upside down world evil, right?
Yeah.
You're taking someone who's a straight A student, lovely parents. Lenin's father wasn't perfect at times. He was cold, but he came from a good family, is the point, right? So you're talking about an otherwise person from a good background who, as the Russian Civil War is starting, as the Bolsheviks have seized power, he begins to say things like, there's no such thing as a revolution without firing squads. And then he starts to make fun of moderates around him, moderates, so to speak, within the Bolshevik Party, who begin to question more the use of more and more extreme means. Oh, I'm sorry. And he's dripping with sarcasm. Oh, I'm sorry. What do you understand about the meaning of dictatorship? If we are to be a weakling, this will not work. Where did you go to school? Where did you learn about how dictatorship itself? There can be no revolution without firing squads. And then he goes on to say, if in England it was necessary to behead one crowned criminal, in Russia it'll be necessary to kill 100 Romanovs. And so it was that you had Tsar Nicholas II and his family awakened in the middle of the night and led into a basement, and Bolshevik thugs come in and say, your life is finished. And you have Tsar Nicholas II shot in front of his four daughters and son as his wife Alexandra is making the sign of the cross repeatedly. And the kids are screaming, and you have a haze of gunfire smoke, stabbings, murder. Vladimir Lenin was responsible. The kid who came from the family with Christmas trees and Easter eggs, he thought it was right and it had to be done. The why behind that is a major part of what the book is about. Not about explaining anything from youth that definitively determines how that happened, but the origins of self-belief systems and the beginning effort to imagine who they are in the world. How does that intersect with education and books and early experiences? That's my focus.
That's also a fascinating story. I'll add that when the shootings were happening, they had all their diamonds sewn into the gowns and the bullets didn't work because of the diamonds. And then they had to stab them. It was just an awful, awful, awful thing. And those weren't the only Romanovs that got killed, because there were the other cousins who they threw into a well and then put grenades into the well to try to blow them up and kill them that way. But the grenades didn't kill them, so they just sat at the bottom of the well until they died of thirst.
And imagine such horror for real people, right? When the Romanovs are killed, Anastasia, and one of the daughters, fights like hell. Simon Sebag Montefiore's book, The Romanovs, which is a wonderful one. Wonderful book. It talks about that scene, that moment, and it's utterly horrifying. There's the question not only though of what it was like for the victims to have to live through such horror, but how human beings who consider themselves rational sit down at a desk and say, well, this is what must be done.
Yeah. And then someone had to follow the order and all of it. It's just an awful, awful, awful story.
I hate to say it, but it's a story that It's about us. It's about humanity.
Yeah.
People will say, but we're not like these leaders, right? There are things that are different, of course, but as you delve deeper and deeper into their story, I think a takeaway is not only how such people can become so despotic, but how do we make the effort to distinguish ourselves through the guiding values of mercy, empathy, compassion, especially when we're engaged in a political cause and we feel so strongly about it being just, that above all else, the framing values that guide our decision-making have to be empathy, mercy, compassion.
Amen. Well said. Nicholas II was not a particularly good czar. He was one of the worst generals that ever lived, but he was actually a very good dad. If you go online, you can see pictures of, there's a lot of black and white photos of the Romanov family looking very, very human. And it really brings the that sort of terrorist act to the fore. Anyway, I think that's a good way to end it on that story and on what you just said about mercy and compassion, because we're feeling it that way in this country. I feel like there's a trend now towards meanness just in general. I mean, for want of a better word, the MAGA contingent just seems to be, about meanness, about selfishness, about not giving a shit about other people. I had a guest on a couple podcast episodes ago named Mark Borey, and we were talking about COVID, and he said, at the end of the day, isn't COVID a morality test? And how you approach COVID and what your personal response to it, doesn't that tell you how you feel about the old and the elderly and the sick and the children and this and that? And I think that's true in this, these trucker convoys out there to protest something as basic as wearing masks. What all that's doing is trying to be part of society and keep people safe. And, it's the ultimate and easiest act of compassion. And we seem to have, or a contingent of people in this country seem to have forgotten how to do that, or just don't place any emphasis on it at all. So I don't know.
I really struggle with it. And I think for me, in terms of my the focus of my writing and my research, it has been to try to put myself in the mind, as disturbing as it is, of how individuals rationalize something that I find really horrible, right? And so I think we end this conversation and with how we started, right? The notion of North Korea is objectively a terrible place led by a heinous regime. To listen to North Koreans, I wanted to listen to what they had to say, not with any illusions about the evils of their regime, but about their humanity. And in saying that, I'm not equating North Koreans, right, with the trucker convoy or saying anything like that. But what I am saying is, I think there's a lot to be said for doing as much as we can to listen and try to understand the ideological mindsets of others, not because we're going to excuse it, not because we're necessarily going to agree or that people shouldn't be held accountable for what they do wrong. But how is the way that we act and speak to one another explicable? How is it a product of belief systems, which can sometimes be quite simple. Other times they can be quite nuanced. And how I think the historian's contribution is the effort to try to understand what also often we might dismiss as being impossible to understand. And we choose to describe as, we might say, oh, well, this is just stupidity or this is just evil. Well, maybe so, right? But is there some greater depth to that? And what do we gain from engaging that? And at the end of the day, it is bringing it back to what I was just saying, right? We should see real people. We should see real people on all sides. And we should mourn the tyranny of those that we seek to combat, even as we struggle with every ounce of our being against what we find to be repugnant.
Wow. Well said. Brandon Gauthier, this was such a great conversation. Thank you for coming on. It's much more emotional than I was expecting, I have to say.
I'm really pumped that you had me on. I love your show.
Yeah.
Really kind of you to have me on. And if listeners are interested in learning more, you can go to beforeevil.com. You can follow me on Twitter at BK_Gauthier. Now that's on the listener to try to figure out how to spell that now.
it's a quiz. We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
It's a takeaway. Yeah. And I hope to have the opportunity to speak to you again.
Yeah, no, I would love that. When does the book come out? It's not out yet.
Yeah, April 26th, it will be coming out, April 26th.
Okay.
And the publisher, Tortoise Books, is currently, if you look up Tortoise Books, you'll find it. There's also a link through beforeevil.com. There's a pre-sale right now for signed versions. And if listeners buy a copy of the book, I will write a personal message in there. I will elaborate maybe on something we've talked about in this show, and I will include that. So if you go on and buy a book, you'll get a handwritten message, and I promise it will be hopefully something interesting, maybe something along the lines of this conversation, disconcerting or something that will be engaging, maybe, you know.
That's a really good idea. Just from a book marketing standpoint, that's a really good idea, I want to say. Shout out to the Tortoise Books PR people.
Yeah,
the publicity awesome. People. Brandon Gauthier, again, I was going to say, where can we find you? But you answered all the questions. You wrapped it up. You landed the plane all by yourself. You didn't need my help, which is good, because I still have a little bit of a cold today. I think I sound a little too much like Lou Rawls, but, you know, we'll get over it. Thanks again for coming on. This was so great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Greg. It was my pleasure.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signe Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay?
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.